This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 2nd of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 239 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up in today's programme, we discuss music and activism with Malak Jandali, a renowned Syrian composer and one of the first artists from that country to get politically involved in the Syrian conflict.
Plus, American novelist Jonathan Lethem will explain why his new novel, Dissident Garden, focuses on a dying breed, the American communist.
Also ahead, one of England's most prolific writers and literary critics, John Sutherland, comes by Midori House for a chat about... Yes, that's right, elephants, or at least one of them, Jumbo, Victorian England's favourite pachyderm and the subject of Sutherland's latest book.
All that plus Tom Edwards will be here for a look at next week's news, and we'll play some great music too. A lot to look forward to today on episode 239 of the Monocle Weekly.
It's amazing, Rob, with the slight cupping of a hand and a squelching of your armpit, the animal noises you can make.
I'm absolutely amazing, aren't I? I was going to do the old trick of taking the pockets out of your trousers.
What?
You know the one I mean. Do you want to see my elephant impersonation? Yeah, that's lucky we're on the radio.
I was actually going a bit slow on that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
You must have been.
It's a baby elephant anyway. Rob, we've had a very, very busy week. Let's move on. We've had a very busy week.
They put a sign on my cage, don't they? Don't feed the animals.
I've been reading lots about football this week because you've been writing lots about football.
Exactly. It's a classic edition of Monocle magazine, all about football. We're putting the finishing touches. We have put the finishing touches to our March issue, which is an Italy-themed special. I was in Milan 2 weeks ago now.
We've put the parmesan on the pasta, haven't we?
We have. We've done that lovely thing that Hale and Pace perfected so wonderful. Black pepper?
Yes, with a giant
black pepper. Yeah.
I wonder where they make those giant pepper mills.
Chili oil, parmesan, black pepper.
Yeah, and so the whole issue is about Italy, and I think most people have at some point in this last month have gone there for one reason or another.
Yeah, exactly. We've gone there with dictaphones switched on. Maybe made a radio report. Maybe there's some bits and bobs to bring back. Maybe we'll hear some sort of tailored reports to fit in with when that issue comes out, Andrew, as well.
That's all to come, plus more trumping. From Robert Bound.
I promised I wouldn't sing this week, so we've got a track. We've got a track which we won't spoil people. We'll put it in a bit later on. But I guess it's time. We've got the one and only Tom Edwards. I wonder what his soundtrack will be this week. It's Tom Edwards' time.
Bringing you all the news you need. It's Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards.
And here he is with his cape flying behind him. Into the news seat. Tom Edwards, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob, and hello, Andrew.
Hello. Very, very welcome to the show. I can say very welcome, but you are
welcome.
Yeah,
why not? No, I feel very welcome.
Do you?
Yeah.
That was the handshake I gave you when you walked in.
Yeah, that was...
That was bordering on the Masonic.
It was indeed.
Look under the table. Look where my trouser leg is.
You're not doing your elephant joke again, are
you? Yeah. Oh, heavens above, what's been going on in here?
What's going to happen next week?
Well, I thought we'd start by talking about... we'd start with sports, because I know that's Andrew's favourite.
We've been talking football.
I've been talking, Andrew, through the transfer window.
Yeah. How's little Joe Cole doing?
Oh, God.
Yeah, I think you need to add another one into the roster.
I think he's retired, Andrew, Joe Cole. Has he retired?
Oh, no, he's still plugging away.
57, he's number 57 for West Ham.
No, it's the Super Bowl tonight, Seattle Seahawks, Denver Broncos. That's a little bit dull. But what I always find interesting is the ads. There's this incredible season, all these big ad campaigns. They launch them to great fanfare. People are very excited. A lot of people actually tune in to watch the commercials and not the tedious sport that goes on around it. And there's a couple of good ones. Interestingly, T-commerce. That's going to be a big push.
What's that?
So that's where you can instantly buy the product as soon as it appears on TV. In this case, attached to David Beckham, because it's underwear, things like that.
Okay.
So you can immediately buy
his pants.
David Beckham's pants as soon as you see him clambering around. I think he's clambering around on something on TV. That's the ad.
Okay, right.
Like on a fixed item, not a human. And there's all sorts of things. SodaStream are going to have a big ad, and there's been a lot of controversy
this
in the last
Scarlett
week
Johansson
with Scarlett Johansson.
Right?
So there's quite a few interesting ones. So I think it'll be interesting for media watchers as well as Gridiron watchers.
There's another very good one for Newcastle Brown Ale, which is being marketed in the States, but it's kind of like a gorilla. They're doing a sort of guerrilla campaign that runs on YouTube. It runs on, I think, on the YouTube channel, if you watch Super Bowl on YouTube. So it's costing them sort of literally about £12.96, but they're reaching sort of 500 million people. And that is how you presumably sell slightly overrated Newcastle Brown Ale
can you buy
to
that
the American...
Can you buy that instantly?
I don't know. I can't imagine.
I can only say Newquay Brown in a sort of...
Imagine how many pairs of David Beckham's pants, Tom, you'd buy after a few drinks of Newcastle Brown Ale.
Oh, I'd be knee-deep.
Knee deep in pants.
Yeah. I just keep buying them using my T-commerce platform.
Using your trigger finger.
Exactly.
What should we have next?
Well, let's go tomorrow. A little bit of politics for you. Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey is making an official visit to Germany. I just think this is quite interesting because, of course, Germany is still Turkey's biggest trading partner, you know, into the tens and tens of billions each year. So he's off to meet Angela and the rest of her high-level cronies for a bit of a chinwag. He's going to speak at the German Council of Foreign Relations. It'll just be interesting to see what he comes out with, see how Turkey's positioned vis-à-vis Europe. Always intriguing.
Angela on one side of the seesaw, Erdogan on the other. Balance.
Erdogan and Angela. I like it.
I think she could bounce him off there if she gave him
a vigorous launch
by a little jolt.
Their legs. Yeah. Well, let's see whether they do that. I'd like them to do that as the actual introductory photo opportunity.
That'd be great.
I don't think they will, but maybe they will.
It's a really great. I wonder if we can do three in a row of this. We've got David Beckham on a climbing frame.
Yeah.
We've got those two on a seesaw. Who is going to be on the roundabout, Tom?
I've got Pope Francis on Harley Davidson.
Classic.
Yeah. Now, you know, I like to give a bit of auction news now and again.
Yeah.
This is always quite fun. Pope Francis is selling his Harley Davidson Dyna Superglide in Paris. It's all in a good for a good
Who
cause.
Who knew he had a Harley Davidson? He's lived off bread and water.
No, he's full of surprises. Well, no, maybe it was an unwanted gift, perhaps, because he is quite a humble man. And
yeah.
He drives, I think, he's like a Renault 4, something very old school.
Okay, yeah, right.
Another sort of old, ancient pastor handed on to him.
I can't imagine him on a hog.
Yeah, it wouldn't be right, would it?
Like,
but you can pick it up for just €12,000, Rob. And it's like
€12,000?
For what is quite literally a holy hog. I'd be into it.
Holy hog.
That's very nice.
Why not? A couple of other little things.
He's pleased with that one, isn't he?
Yeah.
Look at him. He's all pleased.
Well, okay, it just came to me in a moment of almost religious inspiration. End of the week, we're building up towards, of course, the Sochi Winter Olympics. Mired in controversy, very divisive, very interesting. We're going to be looking ahead all week on Monocle 24. We've got our series. Then once it all kicks off, it's just going to get more and more exciting. We'll be looking at different national icons from around the world who are competing. We'll be getting special reports from Sochi. But it starts on Friday.
Is there any snow there yet?
Well, this is the thing, Rob. Is there snow? Are there any facilities? Is anyone going to survive the event? It's not looking...
Facilities? All you need is a mountain.
Well, no. You see, you need all kinds
Don't quote
of,
me on that.
You need all kind of stadiums and such like.
Once the sport begins, I bet everyone will just be watching the sport.
Do you think?
I think so. I think it's one that's like... I'm not so sure
about this.
I think it's probably going to be... When you're up a mountain and they'll have made the snow and they'll have shipped it in.
That's true. Well, perhaps that's the case. It's just, I think the expense, the legacy of all of these costings, the £9 billion 30-mile road they've made and the tens of billions that have just disappeared.
Our news editor, Steve Bloomfield, found a very good headline, didn't he, in the tabloids today.
I think he just still swapped Steve and Tom's jobs there.
Yeah.
No, he found a very good tabloid. For,
no,
It was about partying in Sochi.
All right.
And the headline in The Sun was, "Now is the winter of our disco tents."
That's pretty good.
That's very good. To which Andrew and I wondered how many Sun readers get the Richard III reference.
Probably three.
That's what I thought. As many as there were Richards.
Yeah.
Tom, that was a lively, fascinating weekly news roundup. Thank you very much for coming in.
It's my pleasure as always, Rob. Enjoy the rest of the programme.
You can thank me as well.
And you, Andrew. Thank you so much.
Now, before we go any further, let's hear some music. And that is an excerpt from one of our next guests' compositions, Watani Ana, or I Am My Homeland. But Malek Jandali's homeland is Syria. He's one of the country's most renowned composers, having worked with the Russian Philharmonic Orchestra and the Syrian National Symphony Orchestra, amongst others. He's also been one of the first Syrian artists to actively support the protests against Bashar al-Assad's regime from the United States. Back in 2011, after one performance of the same song we just heard, government forces showed up at his parents' home and beat them both up.
Jandali is originally from Homs, a city that has often been described as the capital of the revolution and one of the worst hit by the bombings. After one tour in Syrian refugee camps with UNICEF in 2012, Jandali decided that he could help with music. He launched his Free the Syrian Children tour, a series of concerts to get the West interested in what was going on in his homeland. Now he's about to launch the European leg of the tour, starting in Croatia in February, and he joins us now from our New York bureau. Welcome to the show, first of all, Malek, and just tell us a little bit about this tour, because I understand that part of the ambition is really just to kind of raise awareness. You're not asking people to kind of write checks to at the end of the concert, you're asking them to kind of go away and do something, to get involved however they can.
Absolutely. The title of my tour is The Voice of the Free Syrian Children. And as you mentioned, we launched it here in New York and we're going to Europe next month. And from the title, it's just giving those amazing, courageous Syrian children a voice in their struggle to gain freedom and human rights in their historic peaceful revolution.
Obviously, Malek, you had no choice. Music is your voice. But it's an interesting way of I don't know, broadening the discussion, perhaps. We see so much photography in newspapers and online. So many words have been written about Syria. A musical response to the civil war there presumably puts people in a different frame of mind. Music is clearly an implicit rather than an explicit art form. Is that what you hope to do, to maybe give people some calm to think about the Syrian problem?
You know, it is not a problem. It's a historic revolution by the people, for the people, for human rights and freedom. And Syrian children were the ones who launched this historic revolution to get rid of dictatorship so they can live in freedom and prosperity and be a part of the global community. And music is a universal language. And what I'm trying to do is to give these amazing children in Homs, Daraa, throughout Syria in refugee camps, and we have millions of them now living in the most harsh, difficult situations, a glimpse of hope and a voice through your program and through main media, because they need to be heard. And all what they're asking for is human rights, freedom, and dignity. And when I met them after crossing the borders in Syria, I realized that the power of people is so more powerful than people in power. And there's no place like home. They are all in refugee camps, living in extreme difficult situation with no food, no electricity. And to me, as an artist, as a musician, I'm doing all what I can to do a meaningful art, not just entertainment, so we can search for the truth and beauty of this historic revolution by the people, by the children of Syria, for a beautiful, free Syria.
Malek, your tour comes at a time when even this week we have the talks going on in Geneva between the regime and the opposition. What you're doing comes at a very difficult moment, because in a way it's clear that, you know, there's very little kind of give or take. There doesn't seem to be likely to be any simple solution at the moment. Yet your music seems to have a kind of an element of hope. And as you talk about the events, you are obviously still filled with some hope about what could happen.
Absolutely. You know, I'm not a politician, but let me just clarify the issue to the audience. The main problem is we have a war criminal and his thugs launching a vicious war on innocent civilians, especially the children. More than 12,000 amazing, beautiful children were killed by this war criminal Assad. And that's the problem. The solution, we need to get rid of that killer so people can live in peace. We need to stop the war that was launched on these people and bring the criminals to justice so people can live in peace and prosperity. Let me tell you a little bit about my beautiful homeland, Syria. My ancestors invented the alphabet. They invented the oldest musical notation mankind ever heard. And you are talking to someone who is 8,000 years old civilization. I witnessed the massacre in Hama in 1982 when the father of that dictator killed more than 60,000 civilians in 2 weeks. So that's nothing new to us, but to clarify to the audience, there is a vicious war launched by this dictatorship regime on the Syrian people, and we as artists, journalists, member of the humankind community, must do whatever it takes to save a Syrian child.
Malik, I wanted to ask you, I know you studied at the Arab Conservatory of Music in Damascus. What has become of that since you left?
I stayed 1 year in Damascus in that conservatory because, and then I left on a full scholarship to the States. And the reason I left is because I was seeking beauty and truth, which I lacked back in Syria. You know, when you are not free, you cannot be a true artist. We need freedom to create and produce real art. So that's why I left my homeland in a beautiful journey away from home, seeking beauty and truth, and so I can become a free artist.
And you're a sort of composer in exile, aren't you? Is Syria, sad though it is, is Syria a more inspiring place for you now as an artist than it was when it was peaceful?
It's historical moments that I'm living today. I wouldn't say it's sad, it's catastrophic, but it's historic in every sense. I see freedom in the eyes of these children. When I met them, and let me speak on behalf of them, if you allow me. If you ask these amazing Syrian children, what do you want? They will just tell you very simple, I want to go back home and I want to be a free Syrian. They are sick and tired of dictatorship and they just want to go back home. They will not discuss politics, they will not discuss all the other symptoms of dictatorship. They will just discuss the cause of the problem, which is the war criminal who has killed their parents and made them refugees in the most ancient land on planet Earth. I mean, Damascus is the oldest inhabited capital in the world. And as I mentioned before, my ancestors in Syria, in Ugarit, invented not only the musical notes, but also the alphabet. And my question to you and to your audience, can you imagine the world today without letters or without music? We can't even touch music, yet it's so powerful, and I can touch the heart of millions of people, and that's what I'm trying to do through my tour, The Voice of the Free Syrian Children.
I'd like to ask you, Malik, about the music specifically before we finish. What are the dynamics? I'd like you to maybe tell us about some of the dynamics of it. I'm reminded a little bit of Shostakovich, a composer who also composed partly in exile and certainly had some dark chapters that were the inspiration for some of his best works. Can you tell me what was in your mind as you were composing these pieces?
You know, I just finished my Syrian symphony, and it's so funny that you mentioned Shostakovich because I just attended Gidon Kremer's concert last night in New York, and they had Shostakovich in it. And you know his symphony number 7, mm-hmm. It was the Leningrad symphony. My Syrian symphony is going to tell the story of the historic peaceful Syrian revolution, and I always emphasize peaceful because 12,000 children, immediately we eliminate religion and politics. I mean, what did a 5-year-old beautiful girl do to be killed by this dictator. So my music is going to tell the story of this historical revolution through my Syrian symphony. And I look forward to inviting you and your audience to a free concert in a free Syria very soon.
Okay, Malik, thank you so much for talking to us. That was Malik Jandali on the line from New York City.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to The Weekly. We're going to have some music of a slightly different stripe now, Andrew. I'm sort of promoting tomorrow's culture show.
Are you?
By doing this. Yeah. Why? Well, I know what you're like on The Urbanist. All I hear is The Urbanist, this, Urbanist,
I'm just
that.
Thinking I should start promoting as well soon.
He's not The Urbanist. He's a very naughty boy. this is from Diane Birch's new record. It's out in America, but for some reason it's not out in Europe yet. But we're having her on the show tomorrow, playing live from the new record, Speak a Little Louder. See what you think of this. This is called Frozen Over. And that was Frozen Over by Diane Birch. And welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. For his ninth opus, American star novelist Jonathan Lethem has chosen to write about one species that seems likely to disappear from the US if it's not already gone, the American communist. Dissident Gardens takes place in the New York borough of Queens and follows a family of activists from 1955 to the days of Occupy Wall Street.
Lethem has long been obsessed with those at the margins of society, and his fiction is largely inspired by his own life, growing up in a barely gentrified Brooklyn within a family of such activists. He popped by Midori House to discuss the book with Monocle's Daphne Denis.
I grew up in a family of 60s radicals, the next wave of protesters and dissidents, and so I identify very strongly with it. I kind of grew up marching around against the Vietnam War and then eventually against nuclear power and in favor of daycare. And I took it as a kind of given that political commitment was a life condition, even though, as I found it, often a very embarrassing one or a very compromising one. And I guess eventually I got enough distance from this experience to realize it wasn't a life condition for everyone, that actually that was a very specific way to live and to grow up. And so I wrote a book about generations of people cursed or blessed with that leaning, you know, of giving themselves to the front lines.
I have to say, this book comes a little bit after Occupy Wall Street, and obviously it ends there. We sort of think of it as perhaps being an inspiration, sort of the moment where all these people came together again. How much of an inspiration has that been for you? How, you know, did you think about this book at the time of Occupy?
Well, I'd begun it and I was well into the writing of it when Occupy arose. And it threw me for quite a loop at one point, because my book felt very dire to me. I mean, it is a book full of disappointments and compromises and defeats, even if it's, I think, immensely sympathetic, and it's kind of act of witnessing of the left in the United States. It was not didn't have a happy ending. And suddenly Occupy came along. I thought, oh, wait, does my book have a happy ending? I ended up, of course, feeling really stirred by it, and it became very important to me personally, and it did insist itself on the project. So it's in the book, which I could never have intended when I started. But Occupy is perplexing. You know, it seemed in one very brief, compressed sequence to recapitulate almost all of the promise and beauty, and also the contradictions and self-defeating quandaries that the American left is capable of generating. And it did it all in, like, you know, 140 characters. It was like the entire left tweeted itself all of a sudden. So it's a great study. To me, also a great encouragement. I mean, I don't really believe it ended just because people are not in the streets anymore. I think it's an unfinished story.
There's one point in the book where your protagonist, or at least one of the main characters, Rose Zimmer, says, "A true communist always ends up alone." And that's kind of counterintuitive, at least when you look at the movements that have generally are associated with communism and, you know, left-wing protests, etc. It's kind of a Trotsky's, you know, sort of take on the whole thing. Is that your conclusion, really? Is that the sort of...
Well, I don't think I'd call it a conclusion, as if the book was a kind of axiom meant to demonstrate this horrible truth, so much as it is a kind of a dark intuition I have that really goes outside even of the question of political movements. I think I'm writing again and again in this book, but in previous books, about the tension between community and individual life and connection and loneliness or solitude. It seems to me, especially in American identity, to be a tension that plays itself out again and again. And so I guess I tend to propose visions of community, whether it's a neighborhood or a rock band or a family, or in this book, utopian political communes. And I tend to see them in terms of their fragility, their temporary nature. But yet what happens inside that moment, you know, Occupy could be seen as another one of these, is still real. It still happens.
You draw sort of a saga of left-wing politics in America through a family in this book. Where did you want to take us with that? Because obviously, as I was saying, American communism almost sounds like an oxymoron.
Yeah, well, I think that part of my impulse was an act of witnessing, just to say such people lived. In fact, many are still alive. These beliefs didn't just evaporate, however much they may be sort of written out of official histories. These sentiments, these yearnings in American life for a transformed society are still in the bodies of the people who believe them, and they still convey themselves in various subliminal ways in the life of the people who came after, and I'm one of those people. I think that the book is about the human experience of giving yourself to a vision of another world, and how beautiful it is, how tenuous it is, how costly it can be, how even embarrassing it can be, and that I didn't have a political conclusion I wanted to lead the reader to. I certainly don't even have one for myself, so much as I wanted to just abide with this kind of life and say what it was like and say what it felt like and open it up for the reader to live through.
From a European perspective, it's kind of intriguing to me to think, how do you see us in Europe, those people who still have extreme left parties?
Well, I'm you know, when it first dawned on me. You know, I think it was in Italy when I was 30 or 31, I was visiting and I met people who were part of active communist political parties. And I realized there was pure continuity, that they had never fallen into such disrepute. You know, in the United States after McCarthyism, people were desperate not to be labeled communists. It was kind of mind-blowing. It really opened up my sense of history. And I have tended, it can be an oversimplification, but I've tended to see America as an amnesiac place and European cultures and European politics as being entrenched in history in a way that, well, has a price. American life is very forward-looking, very optimistic, very revolutionary in its nature, but it's also very ahistorical and heedless. You know, it doesn't remember the past. Europeans can be so entrenched in history that they end up static or cynical. For me, this is another one of the dialogues that I'm really interested in, and the book I think pushes. Well, in a way, it's a European kind of book about American life, because I wanted these characters to be burdened with the knowledge of history, to find history inescapable.
There's one thing that I found really interesting in this book, and that's that every character is quite intellectual. I mean, there's no real proletarian voices, as you may say.
Yeah.
Poor people that are supposed to fight for the workers. It's not a workers' book. It's really an intellectual book.
No, it's about, right, it's about the ideological life. It's about developing beliefs from conversation, from reading, from the cosmopolitan experience of the 20th century, where movements are generated from the top down. It is an intellectual experience, but also an emotional one, because I think the people who persuaded themselves and persuaded each other that they saw a better path, gave themselves to it entirely. But you're right that it's not a book about the salt of the earth people. It's not. In fact, sometimes it's a book about the strange disconnection between an intellectual cosmopolitan communism and the reality of what is to be found when you go and try to unionize a factory or when you create a collective farm. You know, this can be quite disenchanting or disappointing, because the reality of the frontier, the reality of the workers, the reality of the agrarian life, these things don't always match up with the idealizations that are generated by people in cities.
And just finally, for the word of the end, where do you see American communism in 10 years? Do you think you'll still be worthy of a novel?
Well, I don't know if the thing that I'm writing about ultimately in this book, which is the, you know, American transformationalist left, will still wear the name communism, or whether it does now. I mean, I think, you know, there are technically some American communist parties, but I don't think most of the people who are in the streets for Occupy, for instance, would have readily answered yes to the question of, you know, are you a communist? So I think that there's something alive, there's something I at least prefer to believe is alive, that will be urgent in 10 years. In fact, it's urgent now. Maybe it would be safer to call it the anti-capitalist left.
That was American novelist Jonathan Lethem speaking to Monocle's Daphne Denis.
Don't go anywhere. In a moment, John Sutherland will tell us the tragic tale of Jumbo, one of the world's most famous elephants.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks. It's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
as well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hippi, for The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to The Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. I know you've all been looking forward to it. This is the point of the show where we talk to you about elephants. Well, one celebrity elephant in particular, really. Jumbo was Victorian England's favourite pachyderm and later one of the world's most adored animals. He's the reason Disney made a film called Dumbo. He's also the cause of all those elephants you see in circuses around the world.
Although he spent all of his life entertaining children, Jumbo's life is a tragic one. His story and his legacy as one of the most loved animals in the world is the subject of John Sutherland's latest book, Jumbo, the unauthorised biography of a Victorian sensation. And John joins us in the studio now. Welcome to the show, John. I must say this is one of the saddest books I think I've... It's really heartbreaking as you turn the pages. It's a story kind of one elephant, of all elephants in a way, but really kind of man's abuse of elephants as well. It's a tough tale, isn't it?
It is, yes. It's very strange because, in fact, the word jumbo is very much with us. You know, jumbo jets, jumbo cords, jumbo shrimp and so on. There's a line in one of Tennyson's poems, I am become a name. And you could say the same of jumbo. So there's that, but also there's a kind of mythology around elephants which accompanies the very poignant fact that we're in the business of exterminating them pretty efficiently, thanks to AK-47s, poachers, Chinese and Indian love of ivory. Nothing wrong in that, but it is to some extent, you know, sort of just like pianos and billiard balls in the 19th century. If you follow the trail back, it leads to the slaughter of elephants. So Jumbo is, as you say, an exemplary story. And also it focuses, for me, that very, very ambivalent attitude we have to elephants. That's to say, the thing about elephants, everyone wants to see them. See the elephant was a great catchphrase in 19th century America for young men going west to look for gold. There were no elephants on the West Coast, but that was. But and also we like to touch them. The petting zoo actually begins in London Zoo in the 1860s when Jumbo arrives, and children would give Jumbo buns, and then they'd ride on his back, and then they'd stroke his legs. You can't do that with lions, and you can't do it with pumas, and you sure as hell can't do it with rhinoceroses, unless you want to end up looking like a piece of toast on a toasting fork. But we have this idea that elephants are somehow very docile, and they love us. It's a huge mistake, zoologically speaking. Elephants, those who live with them tell us, cannot be domesticated. They're not pets. They can be trained, sometimes rather harshly, and certainly in circuses, very harshly, with sledgehammers and crowbars. But the thing about elephants is they are always captives. They don't even know their own names. I mean, Jumbo, most famous elephant in the world, with a name which is very famous. He didn't know he was called Jumbo. You know, it's very strange. Dogs know that they're called Fido, and cats know they're called Felix and so on, but they didn't know. There is a distance between us, and yet we regard them as pets. Big mistake. The reason there are no elephants in today's London Zoo is because the fatality rate was so high. They kept on killing people or killing themselves. And Jumbo himself was turned into what was called, you know, the children's pet. Firstly, by cruelty at night, and secondly, by self-harm. If you look at pictures of Jumbo, he had no tusks, because every night he would go into his cell, which is what it was, and grind his tusks. And these are teeth, by the way. They're incised teeth, tusks. Grind them against the walls until there was nothing left. He's like a prisoner cutting herself in a prison.
And did the name... Was Jumbo the elephant the subject of your book? Was that the first? Was he christened that? Was that the first time that word was ever used, Jumbo?
It, No one knows the origin of the word. I mean, I think I'm closer to it. In race courses in the early 19th century, if a racehorse was rather clumsy and ran into the wall or something, they call it a jumbo, meaning something clumsy or unwieldy. There are other etymologies. They suggest it comes from the Swahili tembo, meaning chief, but none of them actually, or mumbo jumbo, which is a phrase, just a derogatory phrase about African medicine. None of these really stick. And there's a whole website devoted to the subject, but no one's come up with a really conclusive answer. But the name has taken off now. I mean, in so much so that no one thinks of elephants when they eat their jumbo burger.
and tell me, I think we have this idea that, you know, you're telling the story of this Victorian elephant, which was obviously something of a sensation. But the book also charts, especially here for the United Kingdom, that actually in AD 34, if you looked at your hut, you might have seen an elephant passing by.
I'm a Colcestrian, and allegedly the first elephants, as opposed to mammoths, to set hoof on British soil came with the Emperor Claudius, Derek Jacobi, Robert Graves, came with the Emperor Claudius, or at least his generals were encountering some resistance in a town called Camulodunum, now called Colchester, and so he brought across some artillery, those things that you remember from Gladiator that throw stones or burning oil or whatever, and also 34 elephants. And once the native Colcestrians, the Catavellauni tribe, saw these elephants, they turned and ran, and Colchester fell. And Claudius gave himself the title Britannicus and left somebody else with a broom and bucket to clear up what he left behind, and went back with his elephants. I think one died at Harwich, to have a triumphal march through Rome. So yeah, so the first elephants. In fact, I'm a Colcestrian myself, and Colchester's always had a close. That's what Camulodunum and I is. Always had a close relationship with elephants when they built their great water tower in 1882. They called it Jumbo.
They look a bit like elephants.
It does, yeah. It's now a white elephant in the sense the pound. It's a listed building. I can't pull the damn thing down. And it's costing a fortune. It's got 1 million bricks in it, and they're all repointing, and no one wants it.
Just on that Roman subject, the thing that I hated most, one of the things that upset me in that book was this vision.
I thought you were going to say the wonderful phrase, having a guest on. The thing I hated most about your book.
I'll put it on the paperback. Thank you very much.
There's a terrible bit when you describe why actually Romans weren't very keen even on using elephants for kind of gladiatorial fights, because there was just so much muck to scrape off.
Well, I know, yeah. You couldn't drag them out of the arena. I mean, supposing Russell Crowe came across and, with two deft blows of his sword, severed the trunk, which is the way you kill elephants. That's why, in fact, Hannibal never made it. The other thing is that elephants can't cross ditches. So the Romans eventually realised you build ditches, and Hannibal and his war elephants couldn't cross them. And if they did get close, they just need long swords. But the thing is, once you've got 6 tons of elephant there on the sand and in the arena, it takes a lot of pulling. So lions and Christians are much more fast moving,
easy meat,
and entertain. Easy meat's exactly the right phrase.
And did Jumbo invent our affection for elephants, or was it some sort of remnant of affection that made him such a star?
The ideology of Jumbo is very interesting. First of all, as I say, he gave this sense that nature was to some extent was safe. That in fact, this is the biggest mammal, very dangerous in the wild, and yet somehow little children could ride him, and in fact, members of the royal family could ride him. Theodore Roosevelt rode Jumbo. And Jumbo, in fact, was bought by Phineas T. Barnum, the most famous circus owner in history, in the 1880s. And he became, as it were, the star attraction at the greatest show on earth, as Barnum modestly called his three-ring circus. And Jumbo there, he became ideologically something rather different. What he represented was that American love of bigness, hugeness. He was an exhibit. He was never made to do tricks, standing on tubs with a fez on his head, singing, trumpeting Yankee Doodle Dandy. He never did that. He just stood there, vast. And he came to America at the same time they started building skyscrapers. And you remember, a jumbo jet flies into the biggest building in New York. Now, there is a symbolism there, but as I say, for the Americans, and they loved Jumbo hugely, he was a different symbol from what he was in England in Regent's Park, where, in fact, he was much more a children's friend and much more a symbol of empire.
John, I wanted to ask you about, you've talked about the danger of anthropomorphising the elephant, but did Jumbo's personality change from being shipped over to getting depressed in his cell, as you said?
Yeah, I think his was a sad life. He never had sex. In fact, one of the reasons that London Zoo was rather glad to get rid of him was because when, at the age of 20, male elephants develop their sexual urges, they're very dangerous. They go must, M-S-U-T-H. George Orwell wrote a very famous essay about killing an elephant, and that was a Burmese elephant which went crazy under the testosterone flood of its sexual urges, and he had to kill it. But by the time he got around to killing it, you know, the urge had subsided. It was and it was just, you know, sort of serenely munching whatever was available and looking rather grandmotherly, as Orwell said. But everyone wanted the elephant to be killed, so he went ahead and did it. It's seen a fable of imperialism, another fable of imperialism. So, I think Jumbo's tale is infinitely sad, but one shouldn't be sentimental about it. I mean, the elephants are wonderful. There are two species, African and Indian. They are different species. But they're the only proboscidea who are left, that is to say, the big-nosed ones. There were once 20 or 30 of them, but the trunk is very useful in the short term. It's got 50,000 sort of sense receptors in it. You can swat a fly with it. You can shower with it. You can breathe through it. It's strong enough to knock a tree over as well, but also sensitive enough to pick up a marble. But the thing is, in the short term and medium term, it's very good. But in the long term, it's a disadvantage. It's the simplest organisms which do best in the great evolutionary battle, you know, the battle of all against all. And all we've got left of the, and it's our last sort of contact in some ways with the prehistoric age, you know, with Jurassic Park. All we've got left is this wonderful species, and here we are killing it mercilessly. And, I mean, it used to be if you wanted to kill an elephant and you were a great white hunter, you had to take out a piece of ordnance the size of a small artillery cannon. Hemingway, for instance, Ernest Hemingway had an elephant gun, which was so heavy, in fact, that it was not clear whether or not it would kill him or kill the charging elephant. And yet now, for just a few dollars, you can pick up an AK-47 in Africa, which has a penetrative power. The .762 bullet can go through walls. It can certainly go through the 2-inch hide of an elephant, which is pretty armor plated against spears or arrows or other kind of previous weaponry, even rifles. Certainly, sort of small arms. But now, in fact, they're easy to kill, and there is a market, not for them. Not for the meat, not for the bush meat, but for the tusks. And you cannot take an elephant's tusks off without killing it. And, you know, because of that, because there is this huge market for ivory, elephants are being extinguished.
And I wanted to ask you, finally, the kickoff for the book, John. Is it simply because you loved elephants or you knew that Jumbo specifically was such a good story, maybe a cautionary tale?
I suppose, in fact, I'm not a zoologist, I'm not an expert. I kind of got elephants in the head, and I think... to be honest, I think it was the film Dumbo that did it for me. I had big ears as a child. Some would say, as you get older, your ears get bigger anyway. So presumably...
They're hiding under your headphones today.
What, in fact, Barnum called my auricular appendages are pretty big enough. So, and that movie, it's a very sad film. Very sad film.
It is a sad film. Yeah.
But it bombed because it came out at the same time as Pearl Harbor. And if you remember, at the end of that film, Dumbo goes... dive bombs the circus, which would be so cruel to him. But dive bombing wasn't funny in 1941.
Well, John, an amazing and moving story. And I see that the dedication, I'm always intrigued that dedications in books is you've dedicated this book actually to the last living African elephant.
Let's hope that it's a long time coming. Thank you.
John Sutherland, thank you so much for talking us through Dumbo. And there we have it, Andrew. 239 editions of the Monocle Weekly under our belts.
I was a bit sad about the elephant.
Yeah, I thought all our guests were absolutely wonderful. Yes. But there were moments of... We don't need to apologise for moments of seriousness.
No, we don't.
Seriousness and purpose. But John Sutherland was great. I've always been a fan of him. He's quite a, you know, he's obviously a literary man. It's kind of nice to have someone like that that can sort of, that has such an encyclopedic knowledge, can talk around a subject as much as about a subject. He was pretty fascinating, wasn't he?
Yeah, and just wonderful to hear how the elephant kind of inspired, that one elephant inspired, I think, from the jumbo jet onwards. That we've took that name and it's kind of stayed with us. And, our obsession with the giant, the huge, and how it all started with that poor old elephant.
What's your favourite jumbo thing?
Sausage. No. Okay, well, Rob, it's been a good show.
It's been a jolly good show. But will we be here same time next week?
I'm going to be
same
here.
Same time, same place. We should thank our producer, Daphne Denis, and our studio manager, Claire Urban. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.